This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Dalby Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
Joining me on the Jodcast today is Brother Guy from the Vatican Observatory. Hello and welcome to the Jodcast again.
It's great to be back.
And now you work on meteorites and you have been doing some very interesting experiments about these things. Can you tell us a bit more about your research?
Well, when I arrived at the observatory about 20 years ago, I found they had a wonderful collection, a collector's collection of meteorites, more than 1,000 samples, but not a whole lot of equipment to work on them. So I devised a series of experiments that can do non-destructive measurements of their physical properties, density, porosity, heat capacity, and this kind of survey work, which takes 15 or 20 years really to come to fruition, is the kind of thing you could never do if you were depending on a 3-year grant or hoping to get tenure. But it's exactly ideally suited for someone like myself whose only job is do good science and let people know about it. Among the things we did, for example, was to measure the density in a new way. You know, what's density? It's the mass divided by the volume. Mass is easy. You put it on a scale. Volume is tricky because you can't dump it in water, the classic Archimedean system. Water is going to contaminate the meteorite. But we use glass beads. I got the idea, actually, from watching sugar go into my cappuccino during a sugar break. Working in Italy is wonderful. We use these glass beads in a container of known volume, and it's very quick. You fill the container with beads, you weigh it, you know the density. You put the rock in, fill the rest with beads, weigh it again. The difference in the weights gives you the density of the rock. With this system, we've been able to survey more than 1,000 meteorites of every type. We've come up with trends that go with the iron content, whether or not they've been weathered, what part of the solar system they come from. And we've even been able to use these numbers to work out how fluffy the asteroids are, how much of a rubble pile an asteroid is, when you know from their spectra what kind of meteorite came from there, and you know the density of the meteorite, the density of the asteroid, you compare the two, you can see that most asteroids turn out to be piles of rubble. What started out as a simple measurement, mostly because I didn't know what else to do, has turned out to be a really fundamental way of getting at how these meteorites are put together.
And this meteorite collection you have, has that been collected over a very long period of time by the Vatican Observatory?
You would think, but in reality, no. It was a collection from a French nobleman, the Marquis de Moyes, in the city of Troyes, and I can't pronounce either of those French words properly. But he was a private collector and thought that the Vatican should have a natural history museum. So he wanted to give some samples in around 1905. There wasn't any room in those days. But by the 1930s, after he had died, the observatory had moved to Castel Gandolfo, the papal summer home, and so his widow donated his entire collection to us. Now, from the 1930s, there really were only a few people working in meteorites until I showed up. When I arrived in 1993, my first task was to organize the collection. Since then, I've not only been involved in doing these measurements myself, but also loaning out samples to other people. Meteorites are very valuable, and most meteorite collections have a keeper, and the job title is very appropriate. They very rarely let pieces out. But I'm my own curator, so I'm happy to loan the pieces to myself to try out these different experiments. Also, the fact that it was a private collector's collection means that we don't know how carefully kept it was for the first 50 or 100 years. And that means I'm not as worried about contaminating these samples as I might be, say, at the samples of the Natural History Museum or the samples at the Smithsonian.
You mentioned earlier about weathering. So how can you tell the difference between a meteor that's been weathered on Earth compared to one that's been quite pristine and has just recently been fallen from the sky?
Actually, it's phenomenally easy. Most meteorites, when they're fresh, are a gray color, and they have tiny bits of metallic iron, usually just under a millimeter across, scattered through them. This stuff rusts as soon as it comes in contact with the Earth's air and water, and when it rusts, it turns the rock brown. Eventually, the rusting is so complete that the rock breaks apart and turns into dust. So if a meteorite has fallen into a humid area like Britain, it's rare that it will last more than 10 or 20 or 30 years before it is weathered into dust. On the other hand, if it lands in a dry desert, like the Sahara or the Atacama or Antarctica, it can last for thousands of years intact. Even there, though, it will be partially weathered. And that changes the physical properties, it changes the chemical properties. So one of the things we're interested in is actually quantifying the amount of weathering and how it changes each of these physical properties that we measure.
And you said a lot of these meteors are fluffy. What causes the fluffiness compared to some denser materials that you're seeing?
Now, a bit of terminology. You said meteor. I think you meant meteorite. But it's not the meteorites that are fluffy. Most meteorites are, in fact, not fluffy. They're surprisingly dense, surprisingly well compacted, much more than you might have expected. Meteorites were formed in the gas and dust of the Solar Nebula 4.5 billion years ago. But the meteorites we have today are not balls of dust, like you might find under your bed. They're solid rocks. And one of the great mysteries is what formed them into rocks. Yet, when we go back to the asteroids that they come from, those asteroids are 50% empty space, the kind of porosity you would expect for a pile of sand. Whether the asteroids are piles of sand, piles of pebbles, piles of rocks, piles of boulders the size of the Millennium Falcon, we don't know yet. You know, the surface is dusty, but who knows what's going on in the interior of these things.
And how do you compare the meteorites from what asteroids they came from initially? How do you know?
The best way we can do it so far is the spectra. And in particular, the near-infrared, there are certain bands that are characteristic of olivine and pyroxene, and most meteorites can be roughly classified by the amount of iron in their olivine and pyroxene. Another characteristic, though, is the amount of light reflected from the asteroid, the albedo. Obviously, the meteorites that are known as carbonaceous chondrites tend to be dark, although in many cases it has nothing to do with carbon content. They do tend to be dark. And so meteorites that are themselves dark, that come from asteroids that are known to only reflect 5 to 10% of the light that hits it, you might make a connection there. On the other hand, in recent years, we've begun to get a lot of good video coverage of a falling bolide, the one in Russia being the most famous example recently. You can use these videos to trace the orbit back to the asteroid belt. So we know they come from the asteroid belt, but even better, you can tell whether they're from the inner belt or the outer belt. And we try to do that kind of correlation to see if, in fact, the stony meteorites tend to come from the inner belt, the more carbonaceous meteorites from the outer belt.
And have you got your hands on any of the Russian meteorite sample yet?
That one, no. The Russians are pretty tight holding those. I do have a piece of the meteorite that fell at Sutter's Mill a year ago, April. And that's very exciting because it's a carbonaceous chondrite with quite unusual physical properties. Even though it's relatively rich in carbon and water, it's also very, very hard. And that's a surprise. There was a Martian sugar-type meteorite called Tissot that fell in Morocco 2 years ago, and I've been able to get a piece of that. Most of the modern meteorites I have now are either gifts from people who have discovered them, and they like the Vatican, which is nice, so I get a piece of it, or they're pieces that we've traded for. Because I've got a wonderful collection of 19th century pieces that most collectors don't have, I can trade an extra piece of a 19th century meteorite for some 21st century meteorite.
It must be very good to be your own curator of your collection for science.
It's very, very handy.
So one of the things you're talking about is how do the meteorites actually form from their gas and dust compared to the solid materials that you've been measuring. Can you enlighten us, or is this a big open question that we don't know any answers to yet?
Frankly, it's an open question. We don't know any answers. We know some of the things that probably don't work. You know, sandstones on Earth are turned into stone because of heat and water and high pressures. But we know the meteorites have not experienced long periods of extreme heat. The asteroids themselves are too small to provide a static pressure, and most of these meteorites have not seen running water. A few have, but most of them haven't. So there has to be some other source that has squeezed the dust together. Your typical meteorite, your typical chondrite, has got these tiny balls of maybe a millimeter across of molten and then crystallized rock called chondrules. That probably happened in space, but there are more theories than there are theorists as to how and where. And these are gathered together with a lot of very fine submicron dust of essentially the same composition, all squeezed together very tight. when you look at these things under a microscope or in an electron microscope, you can see that they're not fluffy, that there's not gaps, that really most of the porosity that we measured are cracks formed by shock impact long after the meteorite's been formed into a rock. So whatever did it, our studies have shown it was pretty convincingly complete in the early solar system, and it's pretty uniform regardless of the amount of shock or the amount of heating that the meteorite experienced later on in its career. So exactly how that was, where that was, we're not sure yet. My best guess, very low velocity impacts while the planets were first being formed, but even that doesn't explain everything we see.
That's a very big open question for future research.
Absolutely. I'm hoping somebody will come along and give me the answer, because I sure don't know it.
You also mentioned the stuff that you've been measuring. You've been measuring the mass and the volume to get the density. And then you're also saying you're measuring the magnetic field. But you're doing this in a way without destroying the inherent magnetic field of the meteor. Could you tell us about this, please?
Yes, there's two things you can do magnetic fields for. One is to try to find the magnetic field in the early solar system. And to do this, you measure remnant magnetism. It's very, very difficult to do. Lots of people have tried it. Most people wind up doing it wrong because there are so many external ways that a meteorite could pick up a magnetic field. There are a lot of provocative ideas recently in the literature that suggest maybe the carbonaceous meteorites came from a body with an inherent magnetic field. I think the jury's still out on that. What we're doing, though, is completely different. We're using our own magnetic fields to measure the physical nature of the rock, including the nature of where the iron is. In this case, we take a magnetic field in our detector that's weaker than the Earth's field, so we're not contaminating the meteorite with it, passing it through the rock, seeing how much the rock pulls on the magnetic field. How susceptible is the rock to the magnetic field? It's called magnetic susceptibility. And it turns out this can be correlated with the iron content in the meteorite, which in turn is one of the ways we classify the different sorts of meteorites. And as a result, this is a technique first worked out by Pierre Rochet in France about 15 years ago, and now we're pushing that everybody should do this for their collection. Because you can quickly go through an entire collection, it takes about a minute and a half to measure each rock, see if the number that you're getting for the susceptibility matches what the number you ought to get for a meteorite of this type, and see if the meteorites are classified correctly. To the naked eye, it's hard to tell the difference between an H and an L and an LL ordinary chondrite, and yet they're very different. They probably had different parent bodies. They may have had different origins. And it's nice to have this set up so that, you know, when you're measuring a piece from this rock, it really is what you think it is. We found that in some collections, up to 15% of the samples have been misclassified. It happens, especially if there's not a curator taking care of them year to year. If a collection's been sort of left fallow for 20 years, things will happen to it. And this is a fast way of just clearing up your collection and making sure that things are what you think they are.
That's really cool, and that you found and reclassified all these different meteors, so you can actually do the right kind of science and work out where they come from.
You know that movie a few years ago, Night in the Museum, about the creatures that get up and move? I swear, the meteorites get up and move in the middle of the night. That's the only way to explain what I see.
And you've also been measuring the conductivity of these meteorites. What does this tell us about the properties?
Well, I first got involved in this because 40 years ago, I was doing computer models to see whether or not the icy moons of Jupiter could melt thanks to radioactive elements in the rocky portions. Turns out my models were all wrong. I underestimated the heat production because I didn't know about tidal heating. I underestimated the rate at which heat escapes. And yet, we still had the idea of oceans under an ice cap of Europa. This was our idea. My advisor and myself published this years before the Voyager spacecraft even got there. And yet, I was always suspicious of the models because I didn't know, really, the heat capacity and the thermal conductivity of the rocky portions of these icy moons. I had to look up literature for pure minerals. Now, with my own collection, I have a chance to make these measurements. What we found with the measurements we've done so far in conductivity is that it doesn't really matter that much what the meteorite is made of, whether it's a carbonaceous chondrite or an ordinary chondrite. The conductivity, the rate at which heat flows from one side to the other, is controlled by its porosity. Whether or not the phonons have to jump gaps or go around holes in the meteorite. You can correlate the porosity of the meteorite and what we measure for conductivity. The heat capacity is a measure of how much energy it takes to raise or lower the temperature a degree. That is a measure of what the meteorite's made out of. That also is a strong function of the temperature. The colder it gets, the less the heat capacity is, almost linearly when you're talking about the temperature range of the asteroid belt, you know, from 100 to 300 Kelvin. To come up with an average value of this, we've got a new, non-destructive, quick, and fun way of doing it. We have a Dewar that we fill with liquid nitrogen, allow the nitrogen to boil away very slowly, drop in the meteorite. You can see the weight jump up from the weight of the meteorite, and then it boils like mad until it comes down to liquid nitrogen temperature. Then you look at the weight, and you can see how much extra nitrogen got boiled away due to the heat in the meteorite. There's a number of corrections you have to do that we've figured out how to do, but after you do these corrections, you can come up with a very reliable, pretty robust value for the average heat capacity of this rock. And we hope with enough data like this compared to literature data on how it changes with temperature, we might even be able to extrapolate the heat capacity at higher and lower temperatures from this average value. We've just started doing it. We think this is going to be a new way of characterizing the entire rock, not just a tiny piece in terms of its chemistry, a way of maybe classifying different iron meteorites because we're seeing a big difference in the nickel content. And let's face it, it's always fun to play with liquid nitrogen in the lab.
Oh, definitely. So this is going to be applied to the whole collection of thousands of samples.
This is my plan. This is what's going to keep me busy for the next couple of years, and I'm looking forward to it.
On that note, I wish you well playing with all the liquid nitrogen and your meteorites.
It's fantastic to know that you're holding a piece that was in outer space for 4 billion years. I've never gotten over the thrill of being able to say that.
That's very cool. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.